What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is fascinating African-American Jewish kosher food historian and chef, Michael Twitty. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. You know, last Sunday was Mother's Day, and I'm afraid that while I certainly celebrated it properly with my wife and kids and my own mother, I did not even mention the sacred celebration here on Too Jewish, as several listeners have commented, mothers all. So, today we offer a belated look at Mother's Day so recently passed. Now, the fact is that Mother's Day was started by a woman named Anna Jarvis in 1908, and it became a national United States holiday in 1914. But just 9 years after the first official American Mother's Day, commercialization of the holiday was so rampant that the same Anna Jarvis herself became a major opponent of what the holiday had become, and then spent all of her inheritance and the rest of her life fighting what she saw as an abuse of the celebration. She especially criticized the practice of purchasing greeting cards, which she saw as a sign of being too lazy to write a personal letter. She was even arrested in 1948 for disturbing the peace while she protested against the commercialization of the Mother's Day that she started. Finally, she came to regret having ever done the whole thing. Now, as I look at my MasterCard bill for $44.17 that I spent buying Mother's Day cards this year, I can kind of agree with Anna Jarvis. And that's not counting the flowers, balloons, edible fruit bouquets, and the like that were sent everywhere in this great United States of commercial America this year. Pretty stunningly commercialized, really. Now, if I could just get a few of those florists or jewelers to sponsor Too Jewish... Well, in spite of my reservations about the commercial quality of Mother's Day, not to mention Father's Day, Administrative Professionals Day, and National Letter Carrier Day, I must also admit that I think we really do need to have a special time to recognize, respect, and honor our mothers who gave us life, who cared for and educated and protected and nursed us and nurtured us, and who continue to teach us the central importance of guilt on a regular basis. So, in the spirit of the fifth commandment, honoring our mother and our father, in the true Jewish approach to our belated Mother's Day remembrance today, here's the classic A Yiddish Imame, My Jewish Mother, or really A Jewish Mother, as sung by my favorite world music group and past guests of Too Jewish, Les Yeux Noirs.
Ich will bei euch a kasche fragen, sag mir wer es kennt. Mit welche Teiere vermegens bencht Gott alle men. Men kauft es nicht für kein Geld, das gibt men noch umsiest. Und doch als men verliert das, wie viel Tränen men vergisst. A zweite gibt men keinem nicht, es hilft nicht kein Gewein. Oh, wer es hat verleugen, der weiß schon, was ich mein. A jüdische Mame, es gibt nicht besser in die Welt. A jüdische Mame, oi, weh, wie bitter, wenn sie fällt. Wie schön und lirtig ist in uns, wenn die Mama ist du. Wie treurig finster wird, wenn Gott
nehmt ihr euch Fäule Mabu. Du Wasser und Feier, wollt sie gelaufen, fahr ich Kind. Nicht halten ihr Taille, das ist gewiss die größte Sint.
That was the wonderful Paris-based Jewish world music group Les Yeux Noirs singing the classic A Yiddish Mame for my mom and all moms, albeit a week late, which I'm sure I'll hear about for another 11 and a half months. You know, food is a kind of motherland for many of us, reminding us of home and childhood, but what do you do if you adopt Judaism a little later than birth, and your earliest food memories include both great African-American soul food and fresh challah? Where does that unusual union take you if you become a food historian and a reenactor of American cooking traditions from colonial times? Find out from the fascinating and delightful Michael Twitty when we come back on Too Jewish in just a few moments.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, "To find balance in life is to find happiness." Now, I assume he was a smart guy being a philosopher and all, so it gets me to thinking, balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this, what one mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese, heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce, crispy crust or lightly done crust. It's all in balance for each customer. And as Garaducci says, balance equals happiness, and that equals loyal Mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning, Michael Twitty. He is a most unique guest, a culinary historian, Judaics teacher, known for his cooking demonstrations and his deep exploration of the meaning and purpose of food. He blends his African-American roots from the Deep South with his adopted Jewish culture and faith. He has worked in a variety of, I guess, culinary media, creating all kinds of both museum displays and, I expect, fantastic food. Is working on a project called Kosher Soul and the Southern Discomfort Foods Tour. We welcome Michael Twitty. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you? Well, good afternoon to me here in on the East Coast. I guess this is kind of, you know, thank God we can't call on Shabbos because it'd be the longest Havdalah ever.
Yes, yes. It would give add extra 3 hours. It'd be terrible. all right. So tell me, you know, your biography is probably enough for a whole show, but give us a little bit of sort of your own journey and how you got to where you are.
Well, when I was about 7 years old, I told my mother that I was Jewish. And my mother, being someone who was not exactly cloistered, understood what being Jewish meant because she grew up in Cincinnati at a time when, if you lived in Cincinnati, there were three groups of people: African Americans, German Jews, and white people who came from basically Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee.
My dad grew up in Cincinnati, and that's exactly what he would say, I think.
Yeah. So that was it. And my mom said, okay, you can be Jewish for a week. And then my mother promptly told me about some of the certain requirements of being Jewish, including Brit Milah, if I may say so, and giving up pork, which at that time was not an option for this young lad. And I promptly put the kippah away and decided not to be Jewish for a while. But I did grow up in a in the Kent Mill area of the Washington, D.C. suburbs. Some folks may know about that. Back then, it was kind of Jewish. Now it's Jewish, in the sense of it's kind of become a suburban shtetl, you know. But, you know, that was what I grew up with. I grew up with Young Israel and several conservative synagogues and, synagogues of that nature, traditional synagogues down the street, people walking to shul. I never saw people drive to shul when I was growing up. And that's kind of like the life I knew. Then later on, when I was at Howard University, which is the largest African-American university in the country, I did a lot of classes in Black Jewish relations. And that eventually led me to American University, where I did, you know, Jewish studies courses through a consortium. And then eventually I landed in Magen David Sephardic Congregation in Rockville, Maryland, where I currently live. And the rest is history.
It's a great, great history and a great story. We'll hear much more from Michael Twitty about his journey, and particularly his culinary journeys, which have made him a very prominent culinary historian, when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as a very popular Jewish podcast. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Education is at the heart of the Jewish experience of the world, and teaching American Jews and others in America about Israel has been a major effort led by the American Jewish community and with assistance from Israel, and there's some changes in how Israel is seeking to educate about Israel now in America. Let's talk about that.
It's a very interesting topic. We recently had a session here in Tucson guided by Robbie Gringas, one of the leaders of Makom. Makom Israel was created by the Jewish Agency for Israel to kind of face the challenges with Israel education. For many years, the approach that American educators had towards Israel could be defined by saying, you know, let's take the kids. First of all, let's get them to love Israel on a very simplistic way. And after they really love Israel, then we'll expose them to all the complexities of Israel, because then they will be ready. What actually happens is that the teachers are focused on getting the kids to love Israel. And then when they get to about eighth grade, the kids are gone and they don't get to expose them to the complexities. Later on, those kids, when they grow up, they go into the university and suddenly they're flushed with all those complexities and they get a feeling as if the Jewish education system have lied to them all those years. And they go farther to outside of the supporting area of Israel and they feel that, you know what? We need to throw the baby with the water. They lie to us.
Throw the baby away with the bathwater, right?
So they they not only criticize Israel, but they stop loving it, stopping caring for it, and they're overwhelmed with disinformation without a real ability to handle complexities. What Macomb is suggesting that we should change the paradigma. We should go in another way, use a different vector.
So change the paradigm.
And the idea is that we should try to walk hand in hand, encouraging the love for Israel, and at the same time, at the level that would fit the age group, expose them to some complexities. And one example is the vision that Macomb brings. For a vision, they suggest to take one line out of the Israeli anthem, Hatikva, the hope. And the line is, to be a free people in our land. Now, this line is not as simple as it sounds. First of all, not long ago, just the words to be were not very clear to Jewish people. It wasn't taken for granted the Jewish people will be. Then comes the question. You can add question marks as an educator. What does it mean to be free? What does it mean to be people? What makes us a people? And when you're talking about a free people, what is the price to be a free people? And does that, how does that refer to us giving freedom to other peoples? And then comes the question of in our land. What is the meaning of in our land? Do we really refer to Israel as our land? Is it the only land? Is it our holy land, our homeland? What is our relations with that? What are the borders of this land and how do we define them? And through this vision, you expose the kids and the teenagers to the complexities and you bring it from a place that it's theirs. It's their own. It's part of their identity. And you make Israel part of their Jewish identity. And then when they'll get to college, they'll be ready to handle those complexities of criticism and love, hug and wrestle. And that's the new approach. And I personally love this approach and hope that we can go in this direction here in Tucson.
A fascinating, very interesting piece. Thank you, Guy. And we'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our urbane expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, there was an election in France recently, and Nicolas Sarkozy, the conservative president, was deposed. Well, deposed may not be the word. Defeated by François Hollande, the socialist. That's caused some consternation in Jewish circles, but I'm not sure that any American Jews know very much about French politics. Maybe you can explain it for us.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. The labels that we attach in our minds to French politics correspond frequently to the translation of their party names into English, but don't correspond to reality. So let me give you a little crash course in French politics and your listeners as well.
Merci beaucoup.
So, je vous en prie. You know, I spent a long time, actually two duty tours at working at the U.S. Embassy in Paris. And I went to the French National School of Administration and I actually worked in a French prefecture for 3 months. So I know French politics at the international level, the national level, the regional level, and the local level. And it's very different from American politics. And one of the primary differences is that the French have a lot of political parties. We have two, essentially. We have two major parties and a lot of splinter groups who aren't really players. The French have four or five major political parties and a whole lot of splinter groups who can be players in sort of potential coalition governments. So let's review like the main parties, first of all. The kind of moderate left that we traditionally equate with the Democratic Party in our country is the French Socialist Party. There is no more moderate party that's left of center than they are. They are anti-communist. They are anti-Stalinist. There's a lot of parties. There's a Trotskyist party in France. There's a lot of parties way to the left of the French Socialist Party. Okay. There are now actually three big parties on the right. Traditionally, there were two. One is the RPR, which is the Rally for the Republic, which was de Gaulle's party, which was the mainstream right party. There was a party that was traditionally slightly more centrist, but still right of center, called the UDF, the Union for la Démocratie Française, the French democracy. And together, the UDF and the RPR have managed to defeat the socialists since the time of François Mitterrand. But then there's a far right party that recently made a pretty strong showing in the election.
Right, that's Le Pen.
Run by the daughter of the original Le Pen, who was clearly a neo-Nazi, and who, in a famous election pool that I won handily within the embassy among all the French political analysts, Le Pen shockingly scored something like 16.5% in the first round of the presidential elections back in the 80s. And everybody but me was surprised. And they really are far right and kind of dangerously close to neo-Nazis and overtly anti-Semitic and Holocaust deniers, et cetera, et cetera. So having done this little sweep of the French political picture, I want to move on maybe next week to the meaning of this past election, what effect it will have in Europe, and also the record of the French Socialist Party vis-a-vis the Jews.
Thanks, Tom. Great start. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Dave, Abe, and Moshe are waiting in line to get into heaven. When Dave gets to the front of the line, the angel Gabriel says to him, "Heaven's nearly full today. I can only admit those who've had terrible deaths. So, what's your story?" "Well, I suspected my wife was cheating on me," said Dave, "so I came home early to catch her red-handed. I knew something was wrong when I came into the apartment, but I couldn't find out where the guy was hiding. I went out on my balcony, and there was this guy hanging from my railing. I was furious. I started to kick him, but he held on tight, so I grabbed the hammer and I pounded on his fingers. He couldn't take that, and he had to let go. He fell 20 stories, but he landed on something in some thick bushes, and he just got stunned. So quick, I ran to my kitchen, and in a feat of superhuman, furious strength, I grabbed the refrigerator and threw it over the railing. My aim was perfect. It landed right on top of him, killing him instantly. Unfortunately, all that anger got to me. I had a massive heart attack, and I died on the balcony." "Whew," says the angel Gabriel, "that sounds pretty bad to me," and he lets Dave into heaven. Then the angel Gabriel turns to Abe and says, "Heaven's full, what's your story?" "Well, it's been a very unusual day for me," says Abe. "I live on the 21st floor of an apartment building. Every morning I work out on my balcony, but this morning I slipped on a wet floor and I fell over the edge. Luckily, I managed to grab the railing of a balcony below mine. All of a sudden, this crazy guy bursts out on the balcony. I thought I was saved, but no, he starts to beat on me. I held on, but then he grabbed the hammer and hit my hands, and I let go. I got lucky. I fell into some bushes. I was winded, but okay. And then a refrigerator lands on me, and now I'm here." "Man," says Angel Gabriel, "that sounds like a pretty horrible death. Okay, Abe, you're in." Moshe comes to the front of the line, and the whole process repeats. Angel Gabriel says heaven is full, asks for his story. "Picture this," says Moshe. "There I am, minding my own business, hiding naked inside a refrigerator." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. You know, I first heard the version of that joke from cantor Dave Kane at a Cantor's Assembly convention in the late lamented Grossinger's Resort in the Catskill Mountains of New York, way back in the 1970s. Dave Kane could sit and tell jokes nonstop for hours, which was about how long the huge meals would take. And other cantors, including my dad, Baruch Kohan, would join in. It was an experience not to be missed, or I suspect, in this day and age, ever repeated. And now a word of Torah. This week, we read the portion of Bamidbar, the first one in the book of Numbers, which is given its name for the census that occupies a good part of the beginning of the Torah portion. Superficially, it's just a listing of names and numbers, and not a very interesting text for study or inspiration. But it teaches us a primary lesson. Every human being counts in God's eyes, and should similarly count in our eyes as well. There's an unusual phrase in the beginning of the portion. The survey is to be taken of the entire nation, b'mispar shemot, by the numbering of names. In other words, even though by definition a census is an accounting, a totaling of sums, each individual is to be accounted for not by number, but by name. Each person has a unique identity, a human face. Each is an image of God. The notion that every human being counts is part of our tradition in many ways, from the requirement that we have 10 Jewish adults for a minyan to the requirement that we must view every other person as a tzelem Elohim, an image of God no different from ourselves in holiness. The Talmud tells us that one who saves a single life is accorded the merit of having saved the entire world. Each of us is counted because we all count. Paradoxically, even counting itself can be transformed into an affirmation of sanctity. In this period between Pesach and Shavuot, which is coming up next weekend, we count every day of the Omer as a kind of special preparation, remembering the connection between freedom and covenant. We count each day so that we can make each day count. And when we do the tabulation that lets us know that we have the 10 people required for a minyan, traditionally we don't count by numbers, because that would devalue each human being into a mere digit. Instead, we find a verse in the Bible that has 10 words, and work our way through it until we have completed the passage, thus making every member of that accounting into part of a holy sentence. In a world filled with numbers, it's comforting to realize that we are each much more than the mere sum of our parts. No matter how we seek to quantify and digitize our world, each one of us, especially you, really matters to God. And that is worth recounting again and again and again. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, the extraordinary Michael Twitty, will explain how you can cook true, historically accurate, delicious African-American soul food, kosher, and not lose either the flavor or the meaning when we return on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
If you're going to be traveling to Philadelphia this summer, there's one thing you really must see. After a decade hidden from public view, one of the most important documents in American history is set to come back into public display. George Washington's 1790 letter to the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, in which the first president vowed that America would give to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, will form the centerpiece of a special show at the National Museum of American Jewish History, opening June 29th. Ivy Barsky, the American Jewish History Museum director, said she was thrilled to have acquired the letter, widely regarded as Washington's most eloquent statement on religious liberty. She got it on a 3-year loan. The museum's location in Philadelphia, opposite the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall, means that one of the founding documents of this nation, Barsky says, is really and truly where it belongs. Washington's letters spent decades on display in the Klutznik Museum at B'nai B'rith International's flagship headquarters in Washington, D.C. But in 2002, when financial pressures forced B'nai B'rith to relocate to smaller offices, the majority of its collection, including the Washington letter, was put into an art storage facility in suburban Maryland. Several institutions, including the History Museum and the Library of Congress, have tried for years to pry the letter away, but B'nai B'rith claimed its hands were tied by the letter's legal owner, the Morris Morgenstern Foundation, which would not allow the letter to be moved. Ivy Barsky says she doesn't know what prompted Morgenstern Foundation's representative Richard Morgenstern to change his mind. He called the museum towards the end of last year, 2011, initiating months of conversation that resulted in this loan agreement. Josh Perlman, the National Museum of American Jewish History's chief curator, described the loan as a remarkable opportunity for the museum. Washington's letter is in magnificent condition, he said, though it has been laminated. Perlman said lamination was standard practice in conservation about 60 years ago. Many institutions, including the National Archives, have documents that have been laminated, but hopefully it'll be delaminated in the future. Who knew? Washington drafted this letter following an official reception in Newport in August of 1790. His immortal eight-word phrase was inspired by an almost identical line in a letter he received from the Newport congregation's president, Moses Sexus, who heralded the advent of an American government which to bigotry gives no sanction, to persecution no assistance. Morgenstern bought the Washington letter from a man named Howard Milkman Jr., a direct descendant of Sexus, around 1950. He bought a copy of the Sixus letter as well at the same time, but since his death in 1969, the letters have been controlled by his son, the sole trustee of the foundation, and now by his son's son, Richard Morgenstern. Under the term of the loan, both documents can be displayed for only 3 months each year because of conservation concern. Ivy Barsky would not disclose the amount for which the Washington letter has been insured, but the museum had to raise $1 million just to cover the costs. Jonathan Sarna, the chief historian of the museum and a former guest of Two Jewish, said he was thrilled that the National Museum of American Jewish History was bringing back to life something that has not been seen for a very long time. "You're not just seeing the Mona Lisa," Jonathan Sarna said. "Really, this is an opportunity to educate Jews and non-Jews about one of the great texts of early America that talked about religious liberty in the United States." Indeed.
You have that individual style. So do my hair care products. Use them. They work.
Because if you don't look good, we don't look good. We take pride in you. If you don't look good, we don't look good. Leave out Sassoon.
You may remember him for his iconic short women's hairstyles, or his lines of shampoo and hair care products, or as the man who changed the world with a pair of scissors. But famed hairstylist Vidal Sassoon, died last week of leukemia, was much more than just a fashion legend. Born in London in 1928 of Ukrainian Greek Jewish parents, Sassoon created a geometric updating of the short women's haircut known as the bob for such 60s celebrities as the English model Twiggy, remember her, dress designer Mary Quant, and actress Mia Farrow. These designs are still highly influential today. Sassoon recently referred wryly to how the current high priestess of fashion, Vogue's Anna Wintour, and the teen pop star Justin Bieber both sport unauthorized adaptations of his Vidal Sassoon signature styles. But unlike the bob, which adapted a Paris style developed around the end of World War I, Sassoon's achievement was not based on an idea of liberating or emancipating women just from the tyranny of long hair. Based on his own experiences growing up as a Jew in anti-Semitic England, Vidal Sassoon created hair visually appropriate for a kind of symbolic tribe of women warriors, you know, like in Israel. This warlike inspiration was due to the fact that there was nothing boyish about Sassoon's life, even when he was a boy, and he indeed went to war for his people. When he was just 5 years old, Vidal Sassoon was sent to the Spanish and Portuguese Jewish orphanage in London after his father abandoned his mother. After 7 years in an orphanage, he was able to rejoin his family, and at 14 he was apprenticed to an East End wig maker who provided local Orthodox women with their shtetls. Although passionate about architecture, Sassoon claimed he was inspired by Bauhaus designs, he resigned himself to shampooing the hair of wig makers' clients as his only realistic career option. Just after World War II, though, at the age of 17, Vidal Sassoon joined something called the 43 Group, a group of Jewish ex-servicemen returning from combat after World War II, who found that London was full of public events sponsored by supporters of fascist anti-Semites, like the notorious Oswald Mosley. The fascist-smashing 43 Group, named after the original number of its members, was successful in dampering the post-war public flowering of fascism in Britain by those who were actually disappointed by Hitler's defeat. An anti-fascist fighter with a day job as a hairdresser, when the full news of the horror of the Holocaust reached Vidal Sassoon, his reaction was to make Aliyah in order to join the Palmach, the elite force of the Haganah, the Jewish paramilitary organization in British Mandate Palestine, the predecessor of the IDF. As Sassoon said, "I wasn't going to Israel to sit in an office. I thought if we don't fight for a piece of land and make it work, the whole Holocaust was a terrible waste." Vidal Sassoon's descriptions of Israeli battlefield experiences are the memoirs of a retired foot soldier, not of someone from the arts world. Eventually, Sassoon returned to England to help support his mom, but his experiences in the Palmach during the War of Independence remained an indelible part of his existence, inspiring his creativity. "The sense of what we'd done in Israel's armed forces gave me an enormous confidence. I really felt like I belonged. Funnily enough, it gave me a feeling of belonging in London, too, or anywhere. This is our world," that kind of thing. Working intensely, launching a tireless publicity campaign about his style innovations in the 50s and 60s, Vidal Sassoon eventually managed to make the then-stylish beehive hairdo look old. By doing so, he created what was called the most radical hair shift since the 20s. But despite his very high-flying career, Sassoon never forgot his early London experiences combating fascists. In 82, he established the Vidal Sassoon International Center for the Study of Anti-Semitism at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Their list of excellent publications includes Deborah Lipstadt, another past guest of Two Jewish's book, Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory, among other important works.
Thank you, Vidal. You've changed, Vidal.
It is through such work and a lifetime of dedication to defending the Jewish people that the real legacy of Vidal Sassoon will remain, no matter what Anna Wintour or Justin Bieber are wearing their hair like next year. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Michael Twitty. He is a culinary historian and Judaic teacher. His cooking demonstrations and discussion of how he blends his African-American roots from the Deep South with his Jewish culture and faith and kashrut are fascinating and compelling and I think pretty much unique. Michael, when you put together a food project, I mean, you know, food is so central to Jewish culture. It is also absolutely central to African-American culture. How do you make that bridge?
First of all, I think that we have to talk about what are the interior ingredients of your food. And I thought about this earlier this week. I said, you know, I don't just make kosher soul food or kosher southern food or kosher African diaspora food just based on, you know, halacha and or, you know, the tradition that comes down to the ages from the African side. I make it based on feeling. If you indulge me for a moment, you know how there's schmaltz in Ashkenazi Jewish cooking, right?
Oh yes.
That schmaltz is not just there for a reason. It lends a certain taste and a certain memory and a certain there's a certain process that goes on.
Lends a little bit of cholesterol too. You got to remember that.
Some cholesterol too. Yeah, we can't avoid that part. But there's a certain essence that's there that you go through and say, okay, wow. So this is the taste of Ashkenazi Jewish cooking. In the same way, I think that olive oil or harissa or, you know, anything that's the whole family of spices, and all that stuff from Morocco to Yemen, it kind of, there's a certain pinch, you know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. that says that the neshama of the food is coming from a certain place.
That's great.
So I have to blend the neshamot before anything else happens. I have to think about what place has this come from. Is this a joyous food? Is this food of simcha? Does this food have suris? Is it about pain? Is it about joy? Is it about a blend of the two? You know, I think about the emotional quality of the food before I can even begin making a recipe. But on the practical level, it certainly does involve looking at what are the main ingredients of African diaspora foods. And that's the greatest part about blending these two food traditions, is that you don't just have access to Eastern Europe, per se, or Israel, per se. You have access to the entire Jewish diaspora, which in fact includes parts of Africa and India and China and the Americas. And the same could be true of African diaspora food. It includes every single continent, with the exception of Antarctica, because it's, you know, it's too cold for either blacks or Jews. And I mean, it's just there. I mean, you get access to the entire global reach of cuisine, and then you cook within your seasons, and you cook within a certain pairing of ingredients, and by, you have matzo meal fried chicken, or you have instead of stuffed cabbage, I do stuffed collards, or you might do rice balls from Italy, but employ them in the way that you might do falafel or something for Hanukkah. The latkes, I mean, sweet potato latkes. I mean, it's kind of like you play with the food, and then eventually you get to a place where you go, wow, both of my identities, African-American, Jewish, have come together in a way to satisfy my soul, and that's how I make my soul food.
It's fantastic stuff. You know, black-eyed pea hummus, I mean, all kinds of wonderful things. So maybe I'm naive, but it's always seemed to me that African-American cooking, that African diaspora cuisine, is pretty heavily reliant on stuff we don't eat as Jews, kashrut. How do you work that? How do you work around, you know, bacon, lard, you know, all of the great pig questions?
Well, okay, so I'll be very honest with you. When I do a living history demonstration, more than likely, I'm not always cooking kosher.
Sure.
But the bottom line is that I'm not eating that food. Typically, when I do a living history demonstration, like, say Colonial Williamsburg or something, guests don't know this. I probably shouldn't tell my secret, but I'll tell you because I like you.
Thank you.
Is that I usually have a separate pot. And they'll see the white, fatty stuff, which they think is lard, is actually Crisco. And I make my lunch the entire time. You know, I'm making this beautiful kosher pot while everybody else gets to eat the chazer and stuff. And I believe in the integrity of my work. So I don't want to, you know, sure. When you're a culinary historian, people will, you know, come at you very quickly and say, wait a minute, every little ingredient has to be precise. But then again, I make allowances for myself. It's funny that you ask that because pork is only a very recent thing in our tradition. It happens to be central to the Southern way of eating. There's no getting around that. But it's also very recent. If you go to other parts of the diaspora in the Caribbean and Brazil and stuff, you'll find a lot more. You find beef and poultry, a lot more fish, a lot more seafood. And I think that beef and lamb sometimes fit the bill, sometimes they don't. Smoked turkey is certainly a godsend. You know, it's the best thing that's happened to the Jewish people since chillin', Crisco. And, you know, mother's margarine. I mean, those are the ones. I mean, and I want people to understand that these things are used in moderation, that you don't have to eat, you know, something heavily loaded down in margarine or Crisco. I mean, I'm not making that argument. I'm just saying that to approximate those flavors, a little goes a long way. And we have surimi, right? It's kosher surimi. I should mention that. Because when I was doing, I introduced a program to the conservative synagogue I used to work for called the Silk Road. And every year the kids had to bring in a project about Jews who lived in communities along the Silk and Gold Roads. And one year a girl brought in sushi and said, oh, it's okay. It's imitation crab. And I looked at this thing and I said, oh, my God. It wasn't imitation. No. And I had to give her a little lesson gently while we threw the sushi out about surimi and other approximations. So, you know, the rabbis were right several thousand years ago when they said that God has given us an approximation for every non-kosher food. We just have to find it.
And you're doing a great job of finding it. You know, one of the really great stories about you has to do with another former guest of Two Jewish, Joan Nathan, who taught you how to bake challah and started you on a path.
Yeah. She was really instrumental and foundational. I got to say this about Joan. Really generous lady. I don't think that sometimes we know how someone's simple generosity can change a person's life. You know, my rabbi, Rabbi Chaim Kasorla, who's now in Atlanta, I still call him my rabbi, even though he lived in Atlanta for a number of years.
That's right.
He used to say that everything that happens to us occurs for the sake of someone else. And everything that we do, everything happens to us occurs for the sake of someone else. We make sure I get this right. And everything that happens to others occurs for our sake. So Joan Nathan, she said, well, do you want to go talk to the people from my book, from Jewish Cooking in America? And I said, sure. I need a Sephardic cook. I don't want to just do Ashkenazi. This is when I was working for the Smithsonian as a young 20-something intern helping to develop the Jewish section as a non-Jew of the food waste program. And she said, okay, cool. I know who to talk to. Talk to this rabbi. Go to Mike and David in Rockville. And the rest was history. That's the community that accepted me, that nourished me, that had a diverse congregation. My first Yom Kippur there was, you know, Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Mizrahi, Ethiopian, Indian, Native American, East Asian, Latino, African-American. I mean, that's the kind of, like, place that Magen David has been over the past few years, is where I think a lot of Jews of color feel very comfortable coming there because of the acceptance in the very traditional Sephardi synagogue. And that was my first Yom Kippur there as a Jewish person after going to Mikvah. And that's ultimately traceable to, you know, this lady who's devoted her life to cookbooks and making challah, and she'll always have a special place in my heart.
That's a great story. What's your favorite Jewish food?
Oh, my gosh. Wow. So, there's a top three. In that top three is definitely kasha varnishkas. Oh, man, that's...
You and my mom.
Really? Brisket is definitely in there. But I must tell you that brisket has so many permutations that, I tend to like a brisket on top of the stove with caramelized onions, a little bit of vinegar, raisin, brown sugar, a little bit, just a tiny bit. That's my favorite brisket. I don't like a lot of complications in my brisket. It doesn't need to be overdone. If you're putting more than seven things in your brisket recipe, you're doing the wrong thing. You know, maybe a little shrimp, maybe a little garlic. But I pretty much, you know, told you, that's all you need for a good brisket. You know, you need to kill it. You know, that's not necessary. And I guess matzo ball soup is actually it's a fascination of mine, because I will do whatever I can to obtain the best broth possible. I mean, there's not a single Yiddish and Mama in Crown Heights that can outdo me, and that's a threat. You know, next time I go to New York, it's going to be fighting words.
They can outdo me on
chicken broth.
I don't know. My wife's got a freezer full of carcasses with some duck and turkey carcasses in there, too. She'll go to great, great lengths to get the right broth. All kosher.
Wow.
In making that sort of union that you've been able to do between, you know, what really soul food, African-American soul food, which is wonderful, and Jewish food, which is a very different kind of soul food, do you ever find conflicts besides the kashrut stuff?
I think sometimes one of the issues is spiciness and flavor. For example, there were certain cooking traditions, certain ingredients that were not available in either place. You know, African cultures are not great baking cultures because, number one, wheat doesn't grow in tropical Africa.
Right.
It was brought, you know, to South Africa and to East Africa by the Europeans. Actually, you'll find this very interesting. In Central Africa, when the Portuguese arrived in the 1400s, they converted, well, the king of Congo converted to Christianity, Catholicism. And one of his demands was, by the way, I want you to bring from me, Portugal, men and women who know how to grow wheat and who can raise grapes so that we can have the bread of the earth and the fruit of the vine. How, you know, ironic is that?
Yeah.
And they tried to grow grapes. They tried to grow wheat, and neither one was very successful. So they ended up having to switch to cassava and palm wine, the native bread and wine of the place. I bet you there were Jews, by the way, Rabbi, who actually, no, that, another fourth fact. There were Jews who were escaping the Inquisition who went to Central Africa and were in hiding in Central Africa. And some assimilated in, some converted out. But I bet you they had that cassava and that palm wine as their
motzi and kiddush.
Right, they're motzi and they're kiddush.
Yeah.
So there are conflicts about certain ingredients. I mean, the African diaspora foods are more spicy. There's a lot more smoked meat, smoking things in terms of preserving fish and meat, and even some grains, dried vegetables. There's a lot more vegetables in the African diaspora, African tradition, than there would be in the Ashkenazi tradition. But, you know, I make certain things like I make a mango challah.
Mm.
You know, mangoes are endemic to Africa and Asia. And I'm like, well, why not make, people make raisin challah. Why not make a mango challah? So, you know, things of that nature kind of play on that. Or you can do a barbecue brisket. And I do a wonderful West African brisket and a wonderful, like, a Carolina barbecue brisket with mustard and, vinegar. And, you know, all of that stuff, you know, kind of works together. But you're right. There are some times where you go, how am I going to make this work?
So when are you coming to Tucson to make dinner for me? That's what I really want to know.
I have to get through this tour of the South first. And then we can talk about Arizona.
Well, we're South. You know, you can't get much further south than Arizona.
You are the Sun Belt. That is very true.
I want to thank Michael Twitty for a great visit here on Too Jewish. What's the best place to go to find your stuff on your website?
Great. Well, there are two blogs that I'm working with now. My website is michaelwilliamtwitty.com. And that's just my, you know, that's just kind of how to find me and kind of what I'm doing every now and then. But my blogs are probably more important. And that's Afro Culinaria. That's AfroCulinaria.com.
It's a great blog,
and
by the way.
Thank you so much. And I try, and visitors can always look at the side, and I've broken it up into different subjects, one of which is Jewish stuff. So they can always go and find, like, some of these kosher soul recipes. And I'm actually working on, if anybody's interested, several book proposals for folks who want a kosher soul food cookbook, because I'm working on it. It's I got a ton of recipes, and I got to figure out what's what. So I'm actually in the testing stage as opposed to the, you know, hey, I need to think this up stage, because I've been doing this for 10 years. That's how I feed myself. And then another blog I'd like people to check out is called The Cooking Gene. They can read more about that.
Michael, thanks. We'll check in again with you.
Thank you so much. Toda raba.
Bavakasha. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9. Our guest will be Phyllis Goldstein, author of the fine new book, A Convenient Hatred, The History of Anti-Semitism. And, of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website, and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli Mizrahi music star Zahava Ben singing Melech Amiti, the true king, you know, God. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
נשמתי, ואם אתה